Well, my dear sisters and brethren, we look forward to the words of our brother Jim Carey to the subject, Jehu, Yahweh's Avenger.
Thanks, Brother Maynard. My dear brethren and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, with special emphasis, of course, this morning on our sisters. I wonder whether there's something in the fact that there's not very many in the front seats this morning, because we are going to be talking about Jehu, Yahweh's Avenger. Perhaps there's an expectation of some blood and thunder this morning, sisters. Well, I want to just put your minds at rest. I'm quite sure that most of you wondered what on earth we're going to say about Jehu, which would be relevant to sisters. I hope that you'll find by the end of our session this morning that there's a lot in the life of Jehu and those who surrounded him and those whom he was sent to overthrow that is of relevance to each one of us. You see, what we have before us is perhaps one of the most macabre sections of the whole of the scriptures. Blood flows and the heads roll. But that happened for a reason. And it's that reason that we want to explore this morning. Heads were not rolling because there was no purpose behind it. When God sent Jehu, and he was sent by God, as we saw in that reading which we've just done, he sent him to avenge the blood of his servants. And that's the message of verse 7 of 2 Kings chapter 9. When Jehu was told to go forth, Yahweh said through Elisha's servant, "Thou shalt smite the house of Ahab thy master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of all the servants of Yahweh at the hand of Jezebel." That was the purpose of it. And Yahweh was sending forth a man who was going to avenge the loss of hundreds, probably thousands of people who had been slaughtered at the command of Ahab and Jezebel, particularly the latter, because she hated the servants of Yahweh and the teachers that he sent amongst them, and she designed methods to overthrow those teachers in Israel so that she could teach and seduce Yahweh's servants to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed to idols. And brethren and sisters, what we're talking about here is the aftermath of one of the most dreadful ecclesial disasters of all time. And that had been brought about by the dreadful apostasy of Ahab and his wife. It resulted in the loss of eternal life of thousands of people who might otherwise have been in the kingdom of God. But they are not going to be in the kingdom of God because of the work of Ahab and Jezebel. Yahweh didn't forget that. And he set out to avenge those who had lost their lives because they had been turned away from his truth by the teachings of Ahab and Jezebel. And he set out to avenge those who will be in the kingdom but lost their lives prematurely at the hands of the murderers who destroyed them because of what they believed. So you see, we've got a subject before us that concerns Yahweh's vengeance for the loss of almost an entire generation. And I'm going to speak about the loss this morning of one special family. One family that was at the head of the list of those who were being avenged by Jehu, Yahweh's Avenger. He was sent forth on a divine mission. His name means Yah is He. He was a messenger of judgment. And he went forth and did his work very well. So in chapter 10 of 2 Kings, we read this in verse 30. At the end of his work, 2 Kings 10 and verse 30, we read, "And Yahweh said to Jehu, because thou hast done well in executing that which is right in mine eyes, and hast done unto the house of Ahab according to all that was in mine heart," it was God's intention to destroy them utterly, and he did that, and did it well, "thy children," he says to him, "of the fourth generation shall sit upon the throne of Israel." And even though they weren't worthy of it, Yahweh kept that promise, and he preserved the dynasty of Jehu for four generations, and that was probably the longest dynasty in the whole of Israel, because it changed families quite often. There wasn't, of course, like in Judah, a continuous dynasty in Israel. It was changed by assassination frequently.
Well, Yahweh kept his promise, and Jehu's sons reigned to the fourth generation. But we read in verse 31, Jehu took no heed to walk in the law of Yahweh, God of Israel, with all his heart. Yes, he was a faithful avenger. He did what was required of him. In fact, he exceeded his commission. But when it came to the slow work of building an ecclesia, Jehu was not equal to that, because he took no heed to walk in the law of Yahweh. He was interested in one thing, brothers and sisters, and that was spilling blood. And so when you come to the prophet Hosea in chapter 1, there are a very interesting statement made by the prophet which shows us something of the character of this man Jehu. What he did in destroying the house of Ahab and the worshippers of Baal was exactly right. God required of it. But there was something wrong with Jehu's attitude in the performance of that work. And Hosea picks it up in chapter 1. When speaking about the apostasy of Israel, we read in the 4th verse, and Yahweh said to him, call his name Jezreel. This is the son born to Hosea. Call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. So you see, whereas 2 Kings 10 verse 30 commended Jehu for doing what was exactly in God's mind, Hosea 1 verse 4 condemns him for the attitude in which he did it. He enjoyed cutting off people's heads. He took pleasure in seeing blood flow. He got an enormous amount of satisfaction out of putting to death hundreds of people. His attitude was wrong, brothers and sisters. He had a work to do, but he did it with relish because he loved to see the suffering and the demise of others. And yet he was not all brute, this man, as you shall see as we proceed. But I wanted to open by pointing out that while Yahweh was pleased with his work, he was not pleased with the attitude in which he did it. And that's a very important point. We have a work to do, every one of us, in various aspects of the truth. And as sisters, we have a very important work to do. We have to develop a family, whether that family be our own or the ecclesial family. In one way or another, we have a responsibility to develop that family. And we must set about that task. We must set about it with a right and proper attitude. And we cannot go to extremes, as did Jehu did, in whatever work we have to do. And I want to show you that there were two sides to the character of this man. On the one side, he was a brute. On the other side, he was a snake. He's an enigma, you might say. But that, of course, is the way the flesh operates, isn't it? And you come back with me to 2 Kings chapter 9. The reason that we've chosen this study, I think, will become obvious. It is because there are such dramatic contrasts portrayed in the life and mission of Jehu and in the characters who are surrounding him in the record, that we cannot miss the lessons. And they are carefully inserted here that we might learn them. And so in 2 Kings chapter 9, we read in the first verse that Elisha the prophet called one of the children of the prophets and sent him on a mission to Ramoth Gilead. That is where the army of Israel lay. We read that their king, Jehoram, had gone back to Jezreel to recover from wounds that he'd received in the battle. And he'd left his captains in Ramoth Gilead to await his return. And Elisha tells his messenger in verse 2, when thou comest thither, look out there, Jehu the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, and go in and make him arise up from among his brethren. Now I want you to notice the language. It's important that we do. This man who was sent by Elisha, one of the sons of the prophets, was to go to Ramoth Gilead and to enter into the place where the captains of Jehoram's army had settled themselves, awaiting his return, and he was to especially look out one man. His name was Jehu. Yah is he, the son of Jehoshaphat, which means Yahweh is judge. Get the idea? This man was going to be a divine avenger. Yahweh was going to judge through him, and he, Jehoshaphat, was the son of Nimshai. So Jehu's grandfather was named Nimshai, which means to extricate. And he was going to extricate out of the nation of Israel the family of Ahab. He was to go in to find that particular individual, to look him straight in the eye, and to say to him, "You have been appointed king over Israel." Now look, when we read down to verse 3 and 4, we see this man going on his way, taking with him a box of oil. He was to pour it upon his head. He was to go in and find him. And in verse 5 he does. "And when he came, behold, the captains of the host were sitting. And he said, 'I have an errand to thee, O captain.'" Now you just imagine the scene. We'll try and create it here. Just imagine that Uncle Maynard is Jehu. Can never imagine that, but we'll imagine that he is. The prophet comes in, he looks straight in the eye, and he says, "I have a message to you, O captain." And Jehu replies at the end of verse 5, "Unto which of all us?" And he has to repeat himself, "I'm talking to you, O captain." Now if you cottoned on to what that record is saying, Jehu knew, brothers and sisters, what this man was about. There was an expectation in his mind that he would be the one to do the job that Yahweh had in mind. We know that from verse 25, when he talks to his companion Bidkar, and he says, "Take up and cast this man into the portion of Naboth the Jezreelite. Surely," he says, "this is in fulfillment of the words that you and I heard Elijah speak a long time ago." He was an expectation that he would be the man chosen for the job. He had the qualifications. But look at the way he approaches it. Look at the subtlety of this man. He was there amongst his equals, his peers. They were his fellow captains. He had not been particularly appointed above them by Jehoram. And when this prophet comes in and says to him, "I've got a message to you, captain," he says, "Unto which of us all?" In other words, he's really saying, "Well, I don't want to appear as though I'm going to rise above my fellows. Are you really interested in talking to me? You sure it's me you want?" Can you see the subtlety of his mind? And when the prophet says, "Yes, it's you I want," and they go aside, he gives him the message, verse 6, "And he arose and went into the house, and he poured the oil on his head and said unto him, 'Thus saith Yahweh God of Israel, I have anointed thee king over the people of Yahweh, even over Israel.'" And we read verse 7, his mission was to avenge the blood of Yahweh's servants at the hand of Jezebel. And verse 8 tells us that the whole house of Ahab, every male, was to be destroyed. It was a work that he set forth with alacrity to perform. And yet he wasn't yet king. He'd been anointed king, but his fellows didn't yet recognize him as king. And we're going to see how Jehu insinuates himself into that position. He's a very interesting character, this man. Not all brute. There was plenty of snake in him as well. But there's an interesting verse in verse 10. "For the prophet says, 'The dog shall eat Jezebel in the portion of Jezreel.'" And then you have the words, "And there shall be none to bury her." Well, in my Bible, I've crossed out the words in italics. Those are the words "there shall be" and the word "her." And when you read it that way, this is how it reads: "And none to bury." The dogs would eat Jezebel so that there would be nothing left to bury. We're going to find in verse 35 that there was something that you could perhaps bury, because not even the dogs would eat that. But her body was gone. It had been consumed. There would be none to bury. And then the prophet opens the door and he flees. And of course, Jehu's fellow captains see this man fleeing away, and they say in verse 11, as Jehu comes forth to the servants of his lord, one says to him, "Is all well? Wherefore came this madman to thee?" And he said, "You know the man and his communication. Now look at this subtlety. They didn't have the foggiest clue who he was. They didn't know what the mission of that prophet who came from Elisha was. And Jehu knew they didn't know. But when he comes forth and they say, look, is everything all right? What's happening here? Who was that madman who came? And he says to them, oh, come on now. You know who he was. Didn't you arrange to send him to make me king? And look at the result. They said, verse 12, that's a lie. It's false. Tell us now, what's going on? And he said, thus and thus spake he to me, saying, thus said Yahweh, I have anointed thee king over Israel. And they hasted and took every man his garment and put it under him on the top of the stairs, right where he was standing, on the top of the stairs. And they blew with a trumpet, saying, Jehu is king. And so by a stratagem, he had overcome the problem of becoming king amongst his own equals. And it's quite obvious that Jehu knew that had he simply come out and said, I'm king, they would have said, you're a captain and we're a captain. How come you're king? But he knew that if he went about this stratagem, that he would succeed in becoming king amongst them and they wouldn't be able to resist that stratagem. Oh yes, brothers and sisters, he was a cunning fellow, was Jehu. He hadn't finished yet, mind you, because we read in the 14th verse, so Jehu the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, conspired against Joram. We read that Joram had kept Ramoth-Gilead, that he had returned because of the wounds that he had received there. And then in the middle of verse 15, after the bracket, we read these words. And Jehu said, if it be your minds, then let none go forth nor escape out of the city to go to tell it in Jezreel. In other words, he was saying, we don't want any man to go and tell Jehoram that I am now king. But look at the way he phrases it. He was now proclaimed king amongst them. He could have said, now look, this is my first order. My first order is that you will do this. He doesn't say that. He says, if it be your minds. As Rotherham puts it, if such is your mind, or as Gray has it, if ye are truly with me. So he is still using that subtlety which we've seen manifested early in the chapter, that he might ingratiate himself with his fellows and gradually, slowly but surely, place himself in a position of supreme power amongst them. Though, of course, he already had been proclaimed king. And I think we're being told something there, brethren and sisters. And this is a lesson that applies to both brethren and sisters. But perhaps it can be seen today as a lesson for sisters. You know, in ecclesial life, we sometimes observe that same thing being done. We are all one in Christ Jesus, are we not? But there are amongst us those who have responsibility to lead in whatever way that might be. Amongst sisters in particular, perhaps, there are not so many positions of leadership available. True, isn't it? And yet there are those who, by very virtue of their standing, their character, their dedication, or their personality, are leaders. They are able to organise. They are able to get things done and to influence others to get things done. But we would never suggest, would we, that none of us are troubled by the desire to rule. That is a common human failing. Brethren and sisters are subject to it. We like to be influential. And it's just possible, brethren and sisters, that we could adopt the methods of Jehu. We could be very subtle in the acquisition of the power which actually Yahweh had already given to him. And what I'm saying boils down to this, that we ought to be able to exert influence and to lead in the ecclesia of God by virtue of what we are, and not by virtue of how much we might manipulate the situations around us. And Jehu was a wonderful manipulator. You know, if he had been a man of character and standing, it would not have been necessary for him to do what he did. He would have commanded the respect of his fellows. They would have been happy to follow him. But he was at heart a brute. And given a chance, he manifested himself for what he was. And so he takes the army of Joram towards Jezreel, and they cross over the Jordan, and they make their way towards that city where there was ensconced Jezebel, the mother of Jehoram, her son, and Ahaziah, the son of Athaliah and Jehoram of Judah, who was there visiting the sick Jehoram. So they were all there, the ones that Yahweh wished to destroy. And as Jehu makes his way towards that city, he does so furiously. Because in verse 20 we read, "But as he approached Jezreel, and a watchman stood upon the tower, and looked down from that tower, and saw a company coming, he warned the king that something was on. And the king sent out messengers. And as those messengers came to Jehu, and met him, they said, 'Is it peace?' And Jehu said," verse 18 for instance, "'What hast thou to do with peace? Turn thee behind me.'" You can imagine the messenger coming to him, seeing the determination in the eyes of Jehu, and Jehu just looks at him squarely and says, "What have you got to do with peace? You get behind me." And he did. Another messenger goes out, same thing happens. And the watchman in verse 20 looks from the tower, and he told, saying, "He," the messenger, "came even unto them, and cometh not again." Can't understand it. Then he says, "And the driving is like the driving of Jehu the son of Nimshi, for he driveth furiously." My wife said to me this morning, "I know why you're talking about Jehu, because you want to have a crack at women drivers." Well, I said to her, that wasn't the reason, because we normally reserve this one for the brethren, particularly the younger brethren. You see, the word therefore furiously actually means craziness. And Rotherham translates it with mad haste. Moffat has, like a madman. Another translation has, he drives with abandon. There was something quite distinct and unique about the driving style of Jehu. He was known by it. And there's only a certain number of ways that you can drive a chariot, isn't there? I don't know whether we've ever driven a chariot here before, but you've got a horse in front of you and you've got a chariot, you're standing. You either go at walking pace, which is reasonably comfortable, or you go flat out, which can be comfortable for a while. But no one drives a chariot at the canter. You all know when you're riding a horse that canter is the worst of all, because of the fact that there's no springs in the back of the horse, and it's very uncomfortable. Well, at the canter was perhaps the most uncomfortable way to drive a chariot, and yet that was the way he was apparently driving. Now, no one drives like that except a man who was determined to accomplish his mission, a mission in which he took great pleasure to lop off the heads of those who were the subjects of divine vengeance. And here he drives like a madman. He was recognised by his driving. And so Joram makes ready his chariot and he goes out to meet him. And we read in verse 21, and now we get to the meat of our subject. "Make ready," he says, "and his chariot was made ready, and Joram king of Israel and Ahaziah king of Judah went out, each in his chariot. And they went out against Jehu and met him in the portion of Naboth the Jezreelite." Which really means, when you boil it down, that the gate of Jezreel used to pass through the inheritance of Naboth. Yes, brothers and sisters, Naboth actually owned the gate of Jezreel. The land upon which that gate was built and the road that went through it belonged to Naboth. And it was right there that Jehu met the son of Ahab in the portion of Naboth. And it came to pass, verse 22, when Joram saw Jehu, that he said, "Is it peace, Jehu?" And he answered, "What peace, so long as the whoredoms of thy mother Jezebel and her witchcrafts are so many?" And Joram turned his hands to try and escape. And he said to Ahaziah, the king of Judah, "There is treachery, Ahaziah." And Jehu drew a bow with his full strength, and the arrow that he smote him with went through his body, and he sank down in the chariot. And he said to Bidkar, verse 25, and that man's name means an assassin. A lovely companion, wasn't he? An assassin. Take up and cast him in the portion of the field of Naboth the Jezreelite. For remember how that, when I and thou rode together after Ahab his father, Yahweh laid this burden, this doom upon him. Surely, now notice these words, sisters, surely I have seen yesterday the blood of Naboth and the blood of his sons, saith Yahweh. Now you will not find in the record of 1 Kings 21, which we looked at briefly last evening, it's the record of the vineyard of Naboth and the slaughter of Naboth by Ahab and Jezebel, you will not find in that chapter any reference to the sons of Naboth. But we are told here that he did have sons. He had sons who would have inherited his plot, his inheritance in that nation, once their father died. But because Ahab and Jezebel wanted that piece of ground that they might make out of it a garden, a vegetable garden, a garden of herbs, they were prepared to put to death not just Naboth, who refused to sell it to them, they were prepared to put to death his children as well. And they slaughtered a family in Israel. And that's why Yahweh says in verse 7, I want to avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of all the servants of Yahweh at the hand of Jezebel. And she was preeminent in bringing about the slaughter of the family of Naboth. And I want to just point out to you that there are two women who appear in this chapter, one of whom we're going to see very shortly meets a very sticky end, Jezebel, the cause of all this trouble. But there's another one about whom we read absolutely nothing. We don't know her name. We don't even hear anything about her. But we know she must have been there. And she was the exact opposite of Jezebel. She was the wife of Naboth. If he had sons, he had to have a wife. If he had sons of the quality of himself, and there's no doubt about that, that's why they were slain, that he must have had a faithful wife. And as Psalm 128 says, Naboth had a vineyard, brothers and sisters, and in that vineyard he was building. And his wife was like a fruitful vine on the innermost sides of his house. And his sons were like olive plants round about his table. And that man, that faithful Israelite, would have seen the continuance of his family, generation after generation, as they stood against the apostasy of Ahab and Jezebel in that nation, and upheld the things of God's truth, despite the pressures that came upon them. That family would have continued to do that, but Jezebel wiped it out. And it's quite possible that as Jehu made his way towards Jezreel, there was a woman still somewhere in Jezreel who was watching these events with great interest, the wife of Naboth the Jezreelite. How she was faring, we don't know. She would have been a widow who would have had a great struggle to sustain herself in difficult circumstances. But she was still there, and she was awaiting the vengeance of her family, which had been slaughtered by Ahab and Jezebel. So here we have a contrast being portrayed in this chapter between two women. The record is silent about one, except to tell us that she's there, because the sons of Naboth had been slain with him. The other one we read of in verse 30. And when Jehu was come to Jezreel, Jezebel heard of it. In fact, the words "of it" can be crossed out, they're in italics. Jezebel heard. She heard the commotion. And she understood that Jehu had come, that he might take the throne, and that in fact Jehoram, her son, had been slain. And what does she do? Well, it seems incongruous to me. I don't understand the way the mind of women works. and women like Jezebel, I have got absolutely no understanding, except of course that what they are doing is after the flesh. But why on earth would she do what the record next says that she did? When she heard of the arrival of Jehu, she painted her face and tired her head and stuck the face out of a window. Now let's get this straight. Jezebel must have been around 60 years of age. She was not by any means a pretty young lady. She was, brethren and sisters, getting on in years, and her appeal to a younger man like Jehu must have been somewhat limited. I'm not being rude in saying that. I'm just pointing out the facts of life. But why would she stick her head, her painted head, out of a window? Well, let's just examine the words. She painted her face. Now that word, those words painted her face, in the Hebrew are seam, puke. Doesn't sound very nice, does it? Seam, puke, spelled S-Y-M-P-U-W-K. And it simply means to put on paint or dye, particularly around the eyes, because the word had reference to painting stibium on the eyes. And it was in fact a bluish white paint. Now, you know, we think things change in the world, don't we? People are still putting bluish white paint around their eyes. And Rotherham actually translates it. She set her eyes in stibium. Have you ever seen it? I work with a few of these. They're not the age of Jezebel. But it looks almost as though they wanted to keep their eyes open all day. Because what they had done is basically put blue-white cement around the top of their eyelids and some sort of black stuff which seems to make their eyelashes look much larger than what they really are. And it's almost as though they cannot close their eye. It's stuck there. She set her eyes in stibium. And then it says that she tired her head. Rotherham translates it, she ornamented her head. Doesn't mean that she put a tire on it, but she put some sort of arrangement on her head, probably a crown or something, and she did it up in all sorts of knots and tassels and maybe had a blowaway. We don't know. So she got herself all organised. Now, why would she do that? Well, have a look with me at Jeremiah chapter 4. She must have understood that Jehu was coming to get rid of the house of Ahab. He was certainly coming to take the throne, and that would have meant her immediate demise. In Jeremiah 4 verse 30, in a different context, we have words though which seem to apply to the principle of what she was doing. When thou art spoiled, what wilt thou do? Verse 30 of Jeremiah 4. Though thou clothest thyself with crimson, though thou deckest thee with ornaments of gold, though thou rentest thy face with painting, and you'll see that the word for face in the margin is actually the Hebrew for eyes, though thou rentest thine eyes with painting, in vain shalt thou make thyself fair. Thy lovers will despise thee, they will seek thy life. Now remember, brethren and sisters, as we go back to 2 Kings chapter 9, that Jezebel was a harlot. And there's no doubt that she would have perhaps in her time consorted with the prominent men who surrounded Ahab. That was part and parcel of her business. And she may have had something to do in the past with Jehu. And she thought that if she painted up her dial and took out the wrinkles and got herself looking very nice and stuck it out the window, that she might be able to impress him, that she'd make a wonderful queen. and she'd be able to continue to exert her influence in that nation. But you know what? She couldn't hold herself back. And here we have a testimony to the character of this woman. Have a look at verse 31. She puts her head out the window, and as Jehu entered in triumph into the gate, and there he was riding upon his chariot. He'd just slaughtered two kings. As he rose into that gate, she just couldn't hold herself back. And she said, "Had Zimri peace, who slew his master?" You can see it, the anger in that woman. It rose up in her, and she just couldn't accept that anybody could rise up against her family. She gave away the idea of trying to impress Jehu with her beauty, in inverted commas. And she vents her anger against him. And he lifts up his face. Notice the verse 30 said that she painted her face and stuck it out of a window. Verse 32 says, and he lifted up his face to the window and said, "Who is on my side? Who?" And two or three more eunuchs stuck their heads out of the window of the palace in Jezreel. And they looked out and said, "Yes, we're on your side." And he said, "Righto, throw her out." You know, it's a remarkable thing, isn't it? But Jehu was working to avenge the slaughter of Naboth the Jezreelite. His name means fruits. And Jezebel had destroyed the fruits of Naboth. She had killed his sons, Yahweh's heritage. And Jezebel was to meet her end at the hand of men who were fruitless. They were eunuchs. They couldn't have children, and they were not impressed by her physical beauty. They were not impressed by her advances. They could not be seduced. And so they took hold of her, and they threw her down. And so over the page we read in the latter portion of verse 33, "So they threw her down, and some of her blood was sprinkled on the wall and on the horses, and he trod her underfoot." He just kept going. As she landed, splat on the ground, he just ran right over the top of her. That's what Jehu thought of her and her attempts at seduction. But there's something interesting in verse 33 that we don't want to miss about this woman, Jezebel. You know what the flesh is like, brothers and sisters? When the flesh is deeply entrenched in someone's life, they do not want to let life go. The one thing that impresses me about people at work, when you talk to them about the way in which the world is shaping up for Armageddon, and how their life is going to be cut short, how the things that they enjoy, the pleasures of this life, will soon disappear. One of the things that impresses me about it is that they get very concerned and agitated that you should suggest that the things that they enjoy today will be terminated shortly. They don't like to bear that in mind. It worries them. They try and cling on to life. And when, for instance, people in the world have some sort of terminal disease, which they know is going to end their life, it concerns them that they're not going to be able to continue to enjoy the things that they've loved so much. Now, Jezebel was a woman like that. She lived for the present. She extracted from every moment the pleasures that the flesh had to offer. And she made many for herself. And she wasn't about to give up life easily. You know, we sort of imagine in our minds that these three eunuchs, and they must have been big fellows, would have simply got hold of her, one on the legs and one on the arms, and said, "Righto, well, one, two, three," and away she goes. Oh no. Verse 33 says, "So they threw her down, and some of her blood was sprinkled on the wall and on the horses." Why does it say that? Well, if you were thrown from that window out there, you probably wouldn't touch the wall, would you? If someone gave you a heave-ho and you went from that window to the ground, you wouldn't get anywhere near the wall. Why was her blood sprinkled on the wall and on the horses? It's because she had no intentions of letting go. And as those eunuchs got hold of her, she was gouging at their eyes. She was hanging onto them. And as they got her out the window, it wasn't just a matter of saying, "Right, oh, well, now you're on the edge." Woo! She was hanging onto the wall of the window. And as she went down, She went down trying to grasp the wall. She wasn't going to die. How can you take away my life that I can't enjoy my pleasures? She clung to life until she hit the ground. That's the sort of woman Jezebel was. And he ran over the top of her. And then he went in to drink and to eat a meal of fellowship with the men of the city. And then he thinks to himself, well, we'd better bury that woman. She is, after all, a king's daughter. And they went, in verse 35, to bury her. But they found no more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. For not even the despicable Syrian dog could stomach the head, the hands, and the feet of that woman. After all, the head was set in stibium, wasn't it? Very hard to chew through that. But of course we know what it means. The skull represents the thinking that came first and foremost in this list. The feet represent the walk. The hands represent the actions, the works. And those were the things, brethren and sisters, that Yahweh left to demonstrate that they were absolutely abhorrent in his sight. And so verse 37 says, "But the carcass of Jezebel shall be as dung upon the face of the field in the portion of Jezreel, so that they shall not say, this is Jezebel. There will be no memorial of her left." You know what? It's one of the great paradoxes of ecclesial history that though Jezebel disappeared down the gullet of dogs, she is alive today. She was alive in the days of the first century, and she is alive today. The Lord Jesus Christ says so. And we need to be careful that her influence does not end up destroying our sons, our heritage. You know, what follows is a remarkable, an absolutely remarkable series of events. I don't know what time I'm supposed to sit down, but I think I'll take another 5 minutes. Is that all right? Another 5 minutes, or 10 minutes, if you'll give me some liberty. I just want to explain to you why it is that we then have chapter 10. And what I'd like you to do, sisters, is if you would, put your hands in 2 seconds of the Bible, here in chapter 10 of 2 Kings, and in 1 Kings 21. Now, I know you're all familiar with 1 Kings 21, It is that chapter, as we said, where Naboth meets his unfortunate end. Now, some of you might have heard this before, but it's well worth going over again. For those who have heard it and for those who haven't, you're going to see a remarkable correspondence between these two chapters, and you're also going to reflect again upon this fact that when Yahweh sets out to avenge, he does so with a precision that leaves us gasping for breath. His justice is so accurate, so perceptive, so complete, that we take the warning to ourselves that we cannot afford to meddle with those things that belong to him. And so we have in the first verse of 1 Kings 21 this reference to Naboth the Jezreelite having a vineyard. Now you know how it unfolds. Ahab comes and he says to Naboth, "I want your vineyard." Naboth says, "This land belongs to Yahweh. It is my inheritance. I cannot sell it. Even if I wanted to, I can't sell it." Ahab goes home heavy and displeased. Jezebel finds him in that state, and she gets hold of him and says, "Now what on earth is wrong with you?" Well, he says to her, "I wanted the vineyard of Naboth, and he wouldn't give it to me. He wouldn't sell it to me." And Jezebel casts scorn on Ahab and says, "What's wrong with you? Do you not now govern in Israel?" And she proves that that was nonsense, because when he tells her what he wanted, she wrote letters. Have a look in verse 8. She wrote letters in Ahab's name. Who governed in Israel? No doubt about that. She was signing in Ahab's name, just like my wife signs my checks. Doesn't sign my name, she signs her own. But, well, never mind. So she wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal and sent the letters unto the elders and the nobles that were in his city dwelling with Naboth. Now I want you to get this straight. Ahab and Jezebel were in Samaria and they wrote the letters, or she wrote the letters, to the elders of Jezreel. And that's got to be clear in your mind. Jezebel in Samaria wrote to the elders of Jezreel. And in those letters she said, I want you to set sons of Belial before Naboth, whom you are to set on high. You are to make a celebration give praise, to heap praise upon Naboth. Set him on high among the people. Make it appear as though he's the model Christadelphian. And then send in two men of Belial to accuse him and to say you blaspheme God and the people, and the king rather, and that you ought therefore to be killed. And then take him out and stone him to death. So that having set him on high, his demise will completely bring embarrassment and shame upon him and upon his family. And of course they went further than that. They didn't just kill Naboth, they also killed his sons. And then Jezebel, having heard that this was accomplished, said to Ahab, arise and go down to the vineyard of Naboth and take it for yourself. And he did that. And Yahweh says to Elijah, arise and go down and meet Ahab in the vineyard of Naboth. And he did that. And those two men met there, and there was the prophecy given, which Jehu had referred to, that the day would come when Ahab would meet his end and when the dogs would eat Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel. So there's the chapter, 1 Kings 21, and there's the story. Now you have a look at 2 Kings chapter 10. Kings chapter 10 and verse 1, we read this. And Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria. 70 is the number of the Gentiles, brethren and sisters. And Ahab's family was basically a Gentile family. They had never been converted to the truth because their mother was a Zidonian. She was never converted to the truth. Called herself a Christadelphian, but her children were like Gentiles. He had 70 sons in Samaria. Yes, they were sons and grandsons. And Jehu, note this, Jehu wrote letters and sent to Samaria unto the rulers of Jezreel, to the elders and to them that brought up Ahab's children. Now what a verse that is. You know, there's something in there that we have to take careful note of. First and foremost, brothers and sisters, Jehu was not a man who normally wrote letters. He was a soldier who wielded a sword, and he loved it. He didn't sit down and write letters. Why on earth would he write letters? You'll remember, Jezebel wrote letters from Samaria to the elders of Jezreel. He writes letters to who? To the elders or the rulers of Jezreel. Where were they? In Jezreel? No, look at it. He sent to Samaria unto the rulers of Jezreel, to the elders, and to them that brought up Ahab's children. And the word brought up means foster parents. Now look at it. Jezebel wrote letters from Samaria to the elders of Jezreel and said, kill Naboth's children. Kill him and his children. Get rid of that family. Jehu writes letters from Jezreel to Samaria, and he writes to the elders of Jezreel who were in Samaria, the very men who had killed Naboth, and they were the foster parents of Ahab's children. And he says to them, pick out one of your sons, one of the sons of Ahab, and set him on high. Verse 3. Look out even the best and the meanest of your master's sons, and set him on his father's throne, and fight for your master's house. But they were exceedingly afraid and said, behold, two kings stood not before him. And there are echoes there of 1 Kings 21. For they set Naboth on high, and they set two men of Belial before him, and they accused him, and he fell. See it, brothers and sisters? This is divine poetic justice, exquisite justice. It is so accurate. But I want to make a point before I proceed. What on earth were Ahab's children or grandchildren being brought up by foster parents? And here's our contrast. You see, what we find in this record is that Jezebel and her children adopted the policy of having their children brought up by others. And the record is at pains to emphasize that point. As we read on, we shall see that. They put their children into the care of others. But there was Naboth and his wife bringing up their children faithfully in that plot of ground that Yahweh gave to them, and Jezebel destroyed them. They were to be repaid, poetically. So in verse 5 we read, "And he that was over the house, and he that was over the city, the elders also, and the bringers up of the children," notice how it keeps emphasizing that, "sent to Jehu, saying, We are thy servants, and we will do all that thou shalt bid us. We will not make any king. Do thou that which is good in thine eyes." Then he sat down and wrote another letter, the second time, to them, saying, "If ye be mine, and if ye will hearken unto my voice, take ye the heads of the men your masters bends, his sons, his builders of the family name, who you are bringing up instead of their parents, and come to me to Jezreel by tomorrow this time." Now the king's sons, being 70 persons, were with the great men of the city, which brought them up. Thrice in this chapter we've been told that Jezebel's policy was to give her children to others to bring up. And it came to pass in verse 7, when the letter came to them, that they took the king's sons and slew 70 persons and put their heads in baskets and sent them to Jezreel. What a terrible thing that is. You know what they did with them? In verse 8, "There came a messenger and told him, saying, Even as a messenger had gone from Jezreel to Jezebel in Samaria to tell her the death of Naboth and his sons, there came another messenger to Jehu and said, They have brought the heads of the king's sons. And he said, Lay ye them in two heaps at the entering in of the gate until the morning." You know what that was? The entering in of the gate of Jezreel was the possession of Naboth the Jezreelite. What an unbelievable divine punishment that was. And as I said, it impresses upon us this fact, that if we meddle with Yahweh, the vengeance that will come will be exquisite. It will be poetic to a point that we will know and appreciate that he does not treat lightly the bending of his principles. He cannot tolerate the slaughter of his servants. He will not accept any action which might mean the loss of eternal life of those whom he is endeavouring to bring into his kingdom. We must be sensitive to those things. And so as Jehu goes on his merry way, as the blood of Ahab's house soaks into the ground, there remained in Jezreel, perhaps, a faithful woman who understood that Yahweh had avenged the loss of his heritage in the house of Naboth, the Jezreelite.